Welcome back to yet another edition of Comfortably a Numb, the official podcast of the Umbrella Society. My name is Blake Anderson, the program's manager here at the Umbrella Society and the host of this program. I'm coming to you today from beautiful Victoria, British Columbia, on the unceded traditional territories of the Lekwungen-speaking people. We're off to the races now with this new season of the podcast, and the continued support is super encouraging. I'm so glad that the stories of the folks on this program are resonating with the community and our listeners. When someone comes onto this podcast, I've said this before, the stories that they share are incredibly personal. And I feel that having the courage to come on and be so vulnerable on this cast is incredibly powerful and authentic. And that definitely resonates and is so compelling to our listeners. The big goal is always to raise awareness to the world of recovery and hopefully inspire those facing their own substance use challenges to make a step in the right direction. Hopefully the loved ones of individuals in active addiction can find hope in these stories. And also, hopefully the public at large can look at addiction with a new human lens. So this is definitely our hope. And this was definitely our hope for our recovery campaign this September. And what a campaign it has been. Just wrapping it up now. And, we are incredibly excited with the reach of this campaign as well as the response. I really do feel like we need to start looking at this incredibly challenging and complex issue of addiction in a more optimistic light. I know that's hard, obviously, with it being such a hard topic and very polarizing. But, I really think that we need to recognize that change is possible when people are given proper supports and opportunity, and also with a good degree of perseverance. So even though our recovery campaign is over for this year, I'm going to continue to bring on members from this year's cohort to speak about their story and their recovery journey. And today we have a truly special guest. Stephanie has come on to the program to share her personal experience with substance use. Stephanie is a larger-than-life personality. She's gregarious, she's incredibly intelligent, insightful, and truly one of the most charismatic people I've ever met. She has put her charisma to work as a social media influencer and entrepreneur. She is a mother, she's a mentor, an incredible role model for our recovery community. And really, I admire how Stephanie speaks so openly about her substance use challenges. Her story is unique in the sense that she combated her addiction at the young age of 19 and worked through those pivotal years as a sober young adult. Stephanie really understood and understands the importance of having fun in recovery and creating a life for herself without substances. She also recognized the immense power of connection and recovery and committed to finding a social and support network for herself within the recovery community. It is my absolute pleasure to welcome Stephanie to the podcast. Okay, Stephanie, thank you so much for coming in today. It's really great that you've been part of our recovery campaign this year, and seen your face on the side of buses and on our social media, and we actually have a big banner around the office, so there your face is getting known around around town, for being a strong woman in recovery. Really happy that you can come on and speak to this. It's actually been a little bit more of a challenge getting women on this podcast to tell their story. So I think it's really great that you can be a role model and, have the courage to come on and talk about it. So
awesome. Thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Very cool. So how many years now are you in recovery?
16 and almost a half.
16 and a half. Holy shit. I didn't realize it was that long. That's amazing.
It's been a very long time. Cool. I was 19 when I got sober.
Okay.
In recovery. Yeah.
Okay. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Man, so you got tons of time under your belt. Mm-hmm. I would love to get a bit of a backstory and hear. So 19, like that's an early time to get into recovery.
Yeah.
For the most part, most of the stories that we hear, it's into your 20s or even later, where you actually have that kind of conviction to make a change. So what kind of brought you to that point? I'd love to hear as far back as you want to go and start your story. I'd love to hear it.
Totally. I'd love to share it. And yeah, it was quite young because I had just turned 19. So all my friends were starting to go to the bar and I was in rehab. So it was quite an interesting thing to happen at that age. But my addiction started when I was 13, but it started beforehand. And I'll just give you a bit of a background of who I am. So I born and raised in Victoria. I've never lived anywhere else. I've gone traveling all over the world, but Victoria is my home. Okay. I have my parents. My dad was a doctor, a GP in town, and he delivered babies. And my mom was a French immersion elementary school teacher. Okay. And I have a younger brother, and we're 19 months apart. And so we had on the outside, a picture perfect life, right? The nice big home. I rode horses. I did singing lessons. We didn't go without all that kind of stuff. Mm. And our friends were all the same as well. And then what I didn't realize at the time, obviously, because I was a kid, but my mom was struggling with depression. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't understand why I couldn't make her happy. And I was constantly like the teacher's pet, getting straight A's, trying to impress her, trying to look perfect, be perfect, do perfect all right. the time as a young girl. And I just remember like my mom getting angry and walking around eggshells with her in the house and like her falling asleep on the couch often, right? And just not knowing why that was happening. And when I was about in grade 4, my dad's mom moved in with us because she was getting quite sick. And so, because my dad was a doctor, he could look after her. And she was amazing. I loved her so much. And she played such a huge role in my life. But the following year, my parents sat my brother and I down. So I was in grade 5 and he was in grade 4. And they're like, okay, we need to tell you something. And I was like, oh my God, they're going to tell us that they're having another baby. No, they sat us down because my mom was leaving.
Oh, wow.
So my parents decided to separate. And that was devastating. Obviously, going into that conversation, thinking that I'm going to get a sibling to now mom's moving out of the house. Wow. And I didn't see her much for that first year. And then the second year that they were separated, it was 2 weeks at my dad's, 2 weeks at my mom's. So it was a huge adjustment. And that's when my grandma, she really stepped up and took the role of like my second mom. She was always there for us after school because my dad would work late with his practice, you know, made us snacks. She would, you know, just be there for me. I would write songs and sing them to her. And she would always encourage me, even though they were terrible. Like I found some of them years later. I'm like, oh my God.
she was in it. She was, your biggest fan.
Right. Yeah. She was so good. And, around that same time that they were separated, I was at a all French school here in Victoria, and it was a small one. So there was only about 25 to 30 kids per grade, all in the same class. And I started to get bullied by the girls there. It was predominantly like military families. And I know they saw me as a target because I lived in a different area of town. My dad was a doctor. I was pretty, the boys liked me, all that kind of stuff. And it was awful because I just wanted to be friends. I just wanted to have my friends, and they would hang out without me. I'd find out behind my back. They would tell me to my face all types of names like, you're a slut, you're frigid, you're a whore, you're whatever. Like, it was opposite.
And how old were you at this time?
I was like 11, 12. Like, wow. I hadn't even kissed a boy.
Right.
Like, it was just anything and everything that could be thrown at me. And I realize now as an adult looking back, like, you know, those girls were growing up in single parent homes with alcoholics and like, of course, like they were just taking out their hurt, but I don't know,
compassionately, you know, it's one thing, but
It's so different. Cause at the time I was going home crying every day after school. Meanwhile, my parents were separate, all this stuff going on, and my grandma started dying.
Wow.
So all this stuff was happening at once, and I was still getting straight A's. They asked me to skip a grade. I chose not to, cause I wanted to stay with my friends, even though in hindsight, I probably should have skipped a grade.
Right.
My grandma ended up dying, and my parents ended up getting back together at the end of grade 7, beginning of grade 8. And I actually don't remember this at all. Like, this whole time period is blacked out for me. And I now know that this is a sign of trauma. When we don't remember things, it's because our brain's protecting ourselves because our body is experiencing that as traumatic.
Right.
And me as a little girl, I was experiencing trauma, being bullied. My parents were separated, now getting back together. My mom and I butt heads so much. Right. And my dad no longer was there as a support for me because he was a support for my mom now.
Right.
Right. Which he had to do for their marriage. But again, as a child, I don't understand.
And that must have been hard too when you haven't seen your mom very much in a good bunch of time as well, right?
Like the second year, it was like 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, but we fought. Like I would run away from her house often. Like it was not good.
Right.
It was not good. And I was getting bullied at school, like I said, and I wasn't telling anybody. And I finally confided in one of my best friends who lived down the road from me, and she made me go and tell my parents immediately. And my parents were like, you're not going back to that school ever. And so I switched schools to the school that my best friend, Laura Lynn, was going to. And she introduced me to all her group of friends, and they accepted me right away. They loved me. They wanted me around. They made me feel good. And they were also drinking and smoking pot.
Is this like grade 8?
Yeah, grade 8. I was 13 years old. So that's when I started drinking. And I remember the first time I picked up a drink, I was like, I love this feeling. Mm. I love this courage it gives me. I love the way it makes me feel like confident and comfortable. Mm. And I remember wanting more.
Right.
I wanted more that first time. And I actually blacked out that first time too. And I didn't have a lot of alcohol, but I blacked out that night too. And it went on from there. I started smoking pot after that too, but I was very against hard drugs at that point.
Sure.
And those group of friends started to get into hard drugs. And I actually wrote them a letter being like, I'm scared you're going to die. Like, you need to stop doing. Okay. It was like ecstasy. You need to stop doing this. Like, da 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 da.
So you were fine with just the drinking and a little bit of weed and right.
I thought that was
right.
totally that fine, was a, right? And I would skip class to go smoke weed. We were drinking every weekend. Like, this is yeah. grade 8, grade 9 now, right? Like, I was looking back, I was young to be doing right. this, right? Lying to my parents, they didn't know. And then what's funny about that letter I wrote them is that I ended up being the worst out of that entire group of friends only 2 years after that.
Okay.
So really, really interesting. I ended up going on Accutane for acne, which is a really harsh acne drug. And you sign a waiver that you can't get pregnant when you're on it and you shouldn't drink alcohol when you're on it because of how severe it is. It could damage the baby. But also when you drink on it, like, it's dangerous because this drug can also affect your moods. So I, of course, was a teenager not listening.
Right.
I was still drinking and I started to get suicidal on it too when I was drinking. I remember just feeling like, oh my God, I want to die. Like, I think I need to die, right? And like, that terrified me.
Right.
And I think it's just an important thing just to say, like, I didn't act out on it at the time, but I felt like that. And I know that there's a lot of other young teens and people who are drinking or on other medications that feel that way too. And I say that out loud just because I want other people to know, like, they're not alone in that. And that same Absolutely. With me sharing my story of recovery and addiction. I share it. And whatever else I'm going through in my life, I share those kind of things so people don't know they're alone.
Right.
So after that, I, you know, progressed throughout school. My grades dropped. I was still a volleyball player for the city and our high school, and we did quite well. But I started showing up to practices high. I was drinking and driving as soon as I got my license. My car was like our hot box. That's where we kept
right. okay.
all of our drugs. Like, yeah. it reeked. Like, it was awful. And so it got to the point probably around like grade 10, grade 11, where I was smoking pot all day. So before school, at break, at lunch, break again, after school, and then before bed. Right. And I had all like the sprays, the Visine, everything to hide it from my parents and teachers. But, you know, obviously I'm not going to do well at school when I'm doing that.
Right.
And then I started dating this guy who was into cocaine. And I didn't do it with him the first time. I did it randomly with that best friend that had made me tell okay. my parents. We were downtown drinking and there was these guys down there just hanging out. They invited us back to their place to smoke pot. She passed out because we had drank too much. And then they started doing cocaine and they're like, do you want some? And something clicked in my head where I was like, yeah, I want yeah. some. And I did it behind her back. She didn't know that I did it. And, but for some reason I did. And I was addicted from that point on. So I was 17 wow. years old at that point. And at that, as soon as that happened, I couldn't drink without doing it. Like,
right, it just became supplementary to yeah, them, right?
Every time. And I liked that it made me feel in control. And I liked that I could drive still. Right. It's so crazy.
No, but absolutely, though. The reasoning behind it, though, makes sense.
Right?
Right.
Yeah, and I was known.
All of a sudden, sober right up and, right? and yeah, have the confidence at the same time as the control.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And I was known as, like, the good drunk driver. Like, everyone wanted to go in my car because they right. knew that they could trust me. And I took, like, that was a badge of honor for me, which right. is so, like, oh my God, breaks my heart now because I'm like, that's so dangerous. I'm right. so grateful that I didn't hurt anyone or I didn't get yeah. hurt or anything, because that's all we did. My car was the party spot. And so started skipping school, grades. I barely graduated high school. Was doing all the drugs, partying, all that kind of stuff. And I used to have dreams of, like, going to university and, like, getting scholarships. Like, I had big aspirations as a little girl. I didn't care at all. Like, I completely lost who I was right. and what I wanted out of life and all my dreams. I just wanted to party. That's right. all I wanted to do. And so after high school, I just kept working my pizza delivery job. It was okay. perfect because I could drive around and smoke pot and they didn't totally. Care. And I had all the
they
pizza
They leave you
eat.
Alone so yeah. long as you, yeah, get the yeah. pizza where it needs to go.
Yeah. Right. And then I started dating a drug dealer. And of course, we kind of all know how that story goes. Mm-hmm. I had tons of access to everything. We started doing illegal things. I put myself in very, very dangerous situations with this person. And that was after I graduated. So by December, the Christmas after I graduated, my parents and I, my brother, went to a trip to Hawaii. And when we came back, there was a letter on our doorstep. And it was telling my parents everything that I was doing, the drinking and driving, the getting in fights. Like, I thought I was tough when I was drinking too, right? Okay, like, yeah. Don't fuck with me.
Changed your whole persona, right? Yeah, yeah.
You're looking at me now, you're like, really? Right. But now I'm actually sitting here with a broken hand. You're like, maybe you could fuck me up. No, but I thought, my parents didn't know I was getting in fights. They didn't know I was drinking and driving. They didn't know I was doing cocaine. Like, they thought I had a problem, like, with alcohol because they saw the way that I drank and they knew that it was... You know, but I think they chalked it up to being a teenager.
Right. Just kind of going through the rite of passage kind of stuff. Right?
Because most teenagers can't handle the alcohol. Like I went under the radar for a long time with that until this letter came. And so my parents read it.
So this is just a letter that like...
Anonymous.
An anonymous letter. Mm-hmm.
Anonymous. So
it
I didn't know...
spelled everything out.
Yeah. And holy I didn't shit. Know who wrote it. I had no idea. And my parents handed it to me and they made me read it and they said, is this true? And I was like, well, I'm not going to lie to you and say that it's not. And I don't know why I decided to be honest in that moment. Not that I was fully honest, but I told them it wasn't a lie.
Right.
And so from that moment on, they knew that they needed to get me help. So they started leaving like rehab brochures. They started talking to me about treatment and they made me go to drug and alcohol counseling. And I wasn't being honest in that counseling session ever. Right. Either.
Right.
But they were more aware of what was going on. And I would go missing for weekends, for days from them. Like I missed my mom's birthday. I would miss very important family events just because I'd be partying and I would go on benders nonstop, hanging out with people that were way worse than me because it made me feel better, right?
Flying under the radar, right? I'm not like this guy.
Like
yeah.
I'm like totally. Way better than them. I don't have a problem. What are you talking about?
Right.
But my parents finally gave me an ultimatum and they said, either you go to rehab right now or you can get out of the house. And I was like, fine, fuck you. I'm out. Leaving. Okay. So I moved in with my drug dealer boyfriend and
how old are you now? This like 18, 19?
I was still 18.
18.
I was still 18 years old. And so then I started doing all his activities with him, like back and forth to Vancouver. Like it's so crazy the things that we were doing. So I'm like, thank God the cops didn't bust us because like my entire life would look very different at this point.
Right.
But I always thought it's so crazy because at the time I also thought like, they're not going to think that I'm involved in this. All this play's stupid. Like, are you serious?
Totally.
Like, the stories we tell ourselves.
The smoking gun sitting right.
Oh
right
my gosh. Like the cops aren't stupid.
Right.
Of course they know I'm involved.
It's funny what you can talk yourself into though, right?
You justify everything to keep your like lifestyle and addiction alive.
Right.
Right. And around March, my mom took me to Hawaii on a mother-daughter trip. She was trying to reconnect with me, trying to create this relationship with me. And she brought all these rehab brochures to try and convince me to go to treatment. And I looked at them and then I threw them back at her and I was like, no, like, I don't have a problem. I'm fine. Like I want to be doing this.
Right.
But that trip was like really pivotal for my mom and mine's relationship. We got matching tattoos at the time. And so that was March. And the following month is... when I hit my bottom. I hit my bottom and what it was like any other day. Like I had gone on another bender. I found out one of my friends had been hitting on my boyfriend and I called it was in the morning and I called him and was like, I'm gonna go beat her up. And he's like, okay, like whatever, like you shouldn't, Steph, whatever. I go back to the house. They've locked the doors because I told them I was coming.
Right.
And I climbed through the window and attacked her. And then I went back home with a few of my friends because my parents were both at work this day. So I went back to like my family home.
Right.
And I remember calling my boyfriend being like, ha, I got her. And he's like, I'm going to tell your parents that you're doing drugs again. Because I had been telling them that I'd been stopping. That I was just drinking, but I wasn't doing the cocaine. And I started bawling and I was begging and begging and begging him not to tell them. And then something again clicked in my head that day where I'm like, you sound pathetic. Like you are actually begging someone.
Right.
What are you doing?
Right.
And so I was like, okay, well, I'll tell my parents I need to go to rehab. And I phoned my dad at work. He always picked up my phone calls, even when he was with patients. Like, bless his heart. He's a great man.
Right.
Always picked up my calls. Yeah. And I said, Dad, I want to go to rehab. And he canceled the rest of his day. He came and got me. And we started calling treatment centers with my mom later that night. And I ended up at Cedars a few days later.
Right.
So May 2nd of 2007 was my first day in treatment. And I remember getting there and the doctor was like, when's the last time you used? And I was like, oh, like a week ago. So I already have a week clean. He's like, okay, when's the last time you smoked pot? I was like, well, yesterday.
Right.
But that's not a drug.
That doesn't count. Yeah.
Doesn't count. So he's like, okay, today's your first day clean. And I was like, what? Like, what? So anyways, that was my first day. And then I also remember him telling me, he's like, you know, you would have ended up being a prostitute, right? And I was like, I'm offended.
Right.
I'm offended.
Right.
No, I wouldn't have. But like the longer I stayed in recovery and then I saw like where addiction takes people, I'm like, mm-hmm. that totally could have been possible.
Right.
Like if right. we look at like the trajectory of where my addiction took me from straight A student,
right.
teacher's pet to like almost failing high school, doing nothing with my life.
Right.
Doing drug deals, like
when the drugs become the focal point, you yes. know, and the tunnel vision, yeah,
it's yeah.
almost anything's possible.
Yeah,
you can talk yourself into almost anything.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Right. So yeah, so the treatment was honestly what changed my life, and I've been sober right. since that day, okay. my first day of in treatment.
So how was your experience in treatment? I mean, it's always it's so different for everybody, but it's usually pretty groundbreaking.
It was.
Time? Yeah.
It was. It was terrifying for me, obviously. I had just turned 19. I was the youngest person there. Everyone else there was 10 plus years older. And I just didn't know what to expect. And I didn't know anything about addiction, the disease of addiction, the disease model, whatever. Mm-hmm. I didn't know anything. So I was learning all of these things. And I think it probably took me like 2-3 weeks to actually like start to resonate with me that like addiction's a disease. I have this. It's not my fault. I have mm-hmm. it, but it's my responsibility to do something about it.
Right.
And I remember every Friday night, the alumni would come back up, the people who had graduated from Cedars. And there was this one woman and she was like, I'm 9 months, right? And out of everyone I went through treatment with, which is about 60 people, because new mm-hmm. people come and go every single week. She's like, there's only 4 of us that are still sober. We're still in recovery 9 months later. And I remember right. being like, that's going to be me. Like, I'm going to be one of you four. I'm not doing this. And I knew because everyone knew back home that I had a problem with drugs. Everyone right. knew, right? Okay. Like it was talked about.
Sure.
And everyone knew I went to rehab. So I also made this commitment to myself. Well, if you guys know that I have a problem with drugs, you guys know I'm at rehab. I'm going to talk about this. I'm going to mm-hmm. talk. I'm going to do everything in my power to like show you, myself, my family, right. that I'm doing something about it.
Right.
And that, yeah, I do have this.
Right.
I'm not going to hide it.
That's such a key piece. And that's, you know, what we always are talking about in recovery is mm-hmm. you got to talk about it. You got to talk mm-hmm. about the struggles. You got to talk about, you know, what's keeping you going in recovery. Right.
Yeah.
And just like being open about it and not having the stigma of guilt and shame that, you know,
that's it. Right? It's the shame, right? Yeah. It's that shame is like the lowest vibrational on the energy mm-hmm. scale. Like mm-hmm. it keeps us so sick.
Right.
And I remember the first time I went to an AA meeting too. I remember like the first time I went to an AA meeting was actually prior to when I went to treatment.
Okay.
Laura Lynn, the best friend that made me tell my parents,
right.
I was getting bullied. Her, I shouldn't break anonymity. Someone in her life, took me to meetings.
Okay.
For my first time. And I didn't stay sober after that, but I remember hearing my story through other people's mouths.
Right.
The way I was feeling coming from other people's mouths. And I was like, oh my God, I'm not alone.
The relatability.
I'm not alone. Like other people feel like this.
Right.
And and like I said, like I didn't stay sober right after then, but I never forgot it.
Right.
It planted the seed.
Absolutely.
It planted the seed.
Right.
And I think that was like the main thing too. It's like when we talk about guilt and shame, when we're not talking about our addiction or what's going on for us, what's underneath the addiction, mm-hmm. it keeps us in that low spot where we feel like we're all alone. And we've heard this saying in recovery, right? Like secrets keep us sick. Mm-hmm. They truly do.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean that you have to be like me and like you go tell the world that you're in rehab or in recovery. You don't have to do that if you don't want to do it, but you can share it with somebody.
You have to get it out in some way.
You have to get it out.
Right.
You have to get it out. And that part I would say was like the most healing thing for me was hearing other people's stories and then actually starting to speak myself because I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what was going on, but being able to relate to other people was like, it just gave me a lot of hope.
Right.
For my life.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, we always kind of say that, you know, when we keep it to ourselves, we just give power to that side, mm-hmm. to that addiction. Right. And as soon as we talk about it, you know, even if we're not, you know, even if there's no resolution, it still takes that power away. Right. A little bit.
It's really interesting how it does take the power away.
Yeah.
Though. Like saying it out loud, it does. Because when we keep it inside, like our thoughts, we can ruminate on it. Right. Like it goes over and over and over and over again in our head. right? And then getting it out, at least, or like writing it down can also help sometimes.
Right. Just somewhere to just get that out and be able to look at it objectively. And
And so after I got out of treatment, so I was there for 42 days. I liked my treatment experience. To answer that first question, I really liked treatment.
That's great.
I started to feel myself again. Not that I even knew what myself felt like, but I remember like the first time I laughed without substances for how many years, right?
Being able to have fun.
Yes. Yeah. And have like friends. And then I started to see other young people that would come up for the alumni meetings, right? And I started to make friends with them. And I'm like, okay, like this can be fun, right? This, I can do this. Right. And all I knew too was like, I hated who I'd become. I hated the things I was doing and how I was treating people. And I never wanted to be that version of me again, ever. And so I'm like, I'm going to do whatever it takes to stay in recovery. Like that's just, it's first and foremost, the most important thing. Right. And someone said to me, it was, I think it was a counselor up there too, says, I never want to be that version of me again. And she, the counselor was like, well, Steph, you don't have to be that version of you again, but you will if you pick up a drink or a drug.
Right.
And I'm like, there's my choice. There is my choice. Right. So although like addiction isn't a choice, I have a choice in whether I choose addiction or recovery today.
Sure.
Right. And every day. And that's what I learned in treatment too. It's like, we need to remind ourselves every single day that we're in recovery, making your bed, brushing your teeth in the morning. Like how simple is that? But I wasn't doing it, you know, like reading the daily reflections, just doing something, reaching out to another person in recovery,
keeping up that practice,
keeping it up. So learning all those little tools that I started to implement into my life, that's what really helped. And then after treatment's a whole other thing.
Yeah, I mean, so this is, you know, the fact that you're so young and you have such conviction, you know, the amount of people that have gone off to treatment and either not kind of resisted what, you know, the philosophy or really resisted, you know, that early phase of recovery or, you know, got out and then really struggled afterwards is, you know, like that's. And I think a lot of it came down to conviction. This not really, you know, having that, no, I'm not going back there. So what did it look like for you coming back? You know, obviously it's those transitions are so hard. You've just spent all this time working on yourself, redefining this new you, but then you're going back into, you know, same haunts and same relationships. And, you know, so what did that look like?
It wasn't smooth sailing. I'll say and recovery isn't. And that's, I think that's like a misconception that some people have sometimes that they think that like, if you go to rehab or you start recovery in whatever fashion it is that like life's going to get perfect right away. It doesn't life is still life, but recovery gives you the tools on how to handle it. So for me, I went back into my parents' house. Like, thankfully, like I had that support of them. And they always made sure I had access to their cars to get to meetings. So I'm really grateful for that. Otherwise, I had my friends come pick me up for meetings if they were busy. Okay. So what I did was I had a treatment plan after. So I went to 4 to 5 meetings a week. I ended up basically going daily because I loved the way I felt after. And like I never regretted going to a meeting ever. And I needed it.
Like, it's kind of like the gym in a sense.
It is.
You might not feel like you need it, but and you always feel better kind of coming out of it.
Always feel better coming out of it. And I didn't want to fall off the edge. Like, I remember someone telling me, like, okay, if you want to be successful in recovery, you need to put yourself in the middle. So like, go to the meetings, go early, stay late, talk to people, share, make yourself known. Because if you stop showing up, people are going to notice. And they reach out, and it's way harder for you to relapse if people
care about you.
Yes.
Right. Are invested. Yes. Yeah.
But coming back was hard in the way, like, you're right. Like, I was like, oh my God, this spot is triggering to me. Like, I used to use here. I used to use here. I used to use here.
Right.
So what I did in that way is I grabbed my recovery friends. I also made friends in recovery. That was, I had to do that. I had that to put myself out of my comfort zone.
Totally.
We need to do that.
Absolutely.
We need a community. And I know that's hard for a lot of people.
I know.
But if you want to get like in recovery and change your life, you got to do that.
Right.
And you can do hard things. We can do hard things, you guys. Like, you are capable of doing it. So I grabbed my recovery friends and I would go to my old using spots.
Wow.
And then we would make new memories there. Just fun ones.
Yeah, yeah.
And just so now reset. It took the power away.
Cool.
Yeah.
So instead of just like hiding from it and just, oh, I can't go there, you redefined what that place meant to you, essentially.
Yes.
Very cool.
And we would talk about it and just like go play music and have fun. And then it really did take the power away from it. And then I wasn't to talk to my ex-drug dealer boyfriend. But then, of course, I called him the first day I got out of treatment, obviously. Couldn't stay away. That was like another addiction in itself. And we met up. And I remember telling him, like, he can't bring anything around me. And when he met up, like, I could tell he was under the influence. And then I saw like a bulge in the side of his pocket, and I put my hand in his pocket and I pulled out a bag of drugs. And I was like, wow, wow. And then I didn't talk to him for a month after that, because I was like, I need to put recovery first. But then he somehow weaseled his way back in after
infiltrated.
Yeah. And then I went to aftercare group like once a week counseling. Mm. And they told me there, like, you either break up with him or you're going to relapse. Mm. But I just wanted to stay sober so bad. I did. So I broke up with him. And thank God I had people in my life that were honest with me and called me out and told me the truth.
Right.
Like, thank God.
Right.
Because I had a lot of friends that co-signed my shit for years that told me I was good, I wasn't that bad, and oh my God, fuck that person for telling you this. Right. No, now I have people in my life that actually cared about me to tell me the truth.
Yeah. You know, and that's funny. It's, the much better friend is the one who can tell you the truth even if you don't want to hear it, right?
Yep.
You know, those hard conversations.
Yep.
Right? Yeah, it's pretty easy to just be a wingman and, you know, pump your tires.
Yeah.
But it's not the one to actually be like, hey, you know what? You can do better, or hey, I don't like this, right? Yeah. You know, and yeah, so that's really cool.
And I think if we're getting triggered, it's a really good sign that we need to look inwards and dig deep of, why am I getting triggered? Is this actually true? And I'm just in denial about it.
Right.
Like, what is actually going on?
Right. Why is this such a sore point?
Why?
Yeah, right.
Yes. So yeah, that first year, honestly, I went to lots of meetings. I hung out with lots of friends. I did lots of fun things in recovery. Mm-hmm. I got a job. I started upgrading my high school courses because I thought I wanted to be an addictions counselor, but I didn't even have good enough grades to get into Camosun College. Like, I had to upgrade.
You
high
had to,
school.
Yeah. You had to go back to work.
Yeah. And so I started doing that.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That's gotta be empowering.
It was. Right. I felt really good. I'm not going to lie. I loved the way I felt. I loved my new life. I was very open with everybody that I was in recovery. And I talked about it a lot, and it just felt good. But I was working at this job, and it was like a $12 an hour job, like a call center, like AT&T. Okay. You call someone. That's me.
Okay.
Customer service. And I remember looking around, and it was a lot of middle-aged people, very unhealthy, miserable. And I was like, I don't want this for my life. I'm not doing this. And this is when I really committed to go back to school. And so that's when I upgraded my classes. I went to Camosun. I did, what's it called? The 2 year of psychology. I did that. And then I transferred to UVic to get my social work degree.
Oh, wow.
So I did that over a total of 5 years also.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So you have your social work degree?
I have my social work degree.
Okay.
Yes, I do. And I ended up not doing addictions counseling. Life took me on a whole other route that way. But what I will share about this time of being in school, because what was happening on the other side, is I ended up getting a job at Cactus Club, the restaurant, right?
Yeah.
And around alcohol.
Right.
I ended up also getting a job at Upstairs, the nightclub.
Wow. Like, okay. These are like dangerous. Right. Yeah.
Right. Fully in it. But here's the thing too, and I'll explain more about this, about being in recovery. I didn't want to be as scared, afraid of alcohol. Like, I didn't get
in recovery.
You
didn't want to be bubble wrapped. You want it, right.
I got into recovery to live life.
Okay.
So that first year in recovery, I didn't go out. I didn't put myself in any situations that were red flag situations that I felt were dangerous for me. I stayed clear. Mm. The second year, there was a lot of young people in recovery. I went to young people's AA meetings and NA meetings here in Victoria. A lot of young people would go out dancing in recovery. And so I was like, okay, like, I'll go out with you guys because you're safe.
Right.
So people in recovery, and I always made sure to have a drink in my hand. So I always just had cranberry soda. And still to that day, that is my go-to drink when I'm at a restaurant or whatever. I love cranberry sodas. And the trick to that is that when you have something in your hand, people are way less likely to ask you if you want something.
Right. So no one's buying you drinks.
No one's buying you drinks. And if they try, you'd be like, I'm good. Thank you so much. I got one.
Gotcha.
It's way easier. And then being with people in recovery, they know, like, if you need to leave, you leave.
Yeah.
Right?
So, yeah, people have your back.
Yeah. And so then I started to realize, too, when I was out there and having so much fun dancing, right? I was 19, 20. Like,
so you still got to live. It's not like, I think that's the misconception a lot of times. It's like, I've stopped using, basically, but, you know, that chapter of my life is over and I can't have fun anymore. I think that's such a huge piece that people miss. And, you know, when we talk about recovery, it's pretty serious shit that we're, you know, meetings can be pretty heavy, and that fun in recovery is not talked about enough, right? And how to actually have fun and live your life and, you know, enjoy yourself, right?
I've had more fun in recovery than I ever did drinking and using. Right. And of course, there were some fun times drinking and using, but I will say, anytime, did I ever wake up the next morning and be like, I'm so glad I did that last night?
Totally,
never. Just the, like, I'm serious. For me, not once. Like, I woke up awful, like guilt,
riddled in guilt. Yeah.
Totally. Absolutely. But fun in recovery is so important, and it's right. so possible. And like, you can have fun without alcohol and drugs. Mm-hmm. And it was so funny too, because like, people are always shocked. They're like, oh my God, you're actually fun and you're not drinking. I'm like, right. yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's sad that it's you possible. Need alcohol to right. have fun. Like, absolutely. Like our yeah. society is so backwards in that way.
Absolutely.
Right. Like,
yeah, it's such a misconception, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. So by the time that I worked at Cactus and at Upstairs, like I was confident in myself. Like I went to meetings all the time. My best friends were in recovery. Like my 2 feet were in recovery. So right. it's not like I was like, maybe I'll test the waters and go work at these places. No, yeah. everyone that worked with me knew I was in recovery.
Okay.
Everyone.
Because you talked about it.
And they had my back. Always. Right. If anyone tried to buy me a drink, like bartenders would be like, nope.
Right.
and like
okay.
shove them out of the way. Yeah. You know, like it was really cute. Like even though I could handle myself, but it was really right. nice that they were like, nope, she doesn't. Or if like they were doing rounds of shots, like as staff, they would get me one of cranberry juice.
Right.
So I didn't feel totally. Left
so
out.
You're what, right, exactly.
It was yeah. just, it was things like that. And I know like that can ruffle some feathers in the recovery community. Like it always did. Like mm-hmm. where some people are like, oh, I can't believe she's doing that. But on the other hand, it's like, no, good for her for going and living her right. life and not being afraid. And I know that's not the case for everybody. Like not everyone's going to feel comfortable doing what I did, yeah. but it worked for me.
Right.
And I'm happy yeah. I did it.
Well, and I think the missing piece is you weren't hiding your recovery, whereas so many people, they don't want to talk about it. They don't want to share with other people, especially outside of the recovery community, mm-hmm. that this is part of your life and mm-hmm. don't do that. Or they'll discreetly slip it in. Oh, I don't drink, you know, but the fact that you're like, no, I don't drink. I'm in recovery.
Yeah.
That changes everything because yes. like you say, then you have people have your back, you mm-hmm. know, and that, you know,
mm-hmm.
it sets the groundwork, right?
It you does. Know? And yeah. that's literally what I would tell people. They'd be like, oh, can I get you something? I'm like, I don't drink. Why? Because I'm an alcoholic.
Right.
I literally would say that.
Yeah.
So I'm like, why not? Do we have the shame
yeah.
of saying that?
Right.
And it's not that I like identify, I'm Stephanie Rain, I'm an alcoholic. Like right. as we it's, do in the, like that is not my identity.
Gotcha.
But like, I had no problem saying that. Like, yeah, like I will identify as that if I need to, but that's not like where my identity is wrapped up in today.
Right.
Like that's not all of me.
Right.
It's not. I'm so much more than that too. But like, it does explain things. And also I want to remove the stigma. I hated how much stigma was around that.
Right.
I didn't like it. So I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to break that. And I will be that person so that other people can feel safe enough to go explore recovery too.
Right.
And I can confidently say, like, I have helped a lot of people by doing that.
Absolutely.
And that brings me like a lot of joy. Like I'm really, really grateful that I've been able to do that.
Right.
Because I've had a lot of people come to me over the years and been like, I think I want to just come try out a meeting with you. And I'm like, let's go. Right.
Yeah.
Let's go.
And they wouldn't have done that if you weren't so open and willing to share your experience,
exactly.
right?
Exactly. Because yeah. I know a lot of people think too, like we were saying earlier, it's like if you get in recovery, it's like you're going to smoke cigarettes and drink coffee and you die. Like it's like,
you're
not fun.
Hanging on for dear life.
My
yeah.
life's over.
Right.
Like, no, your yeah. life just starts when you're in recovery.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think that was also the fact that you hit the ground running and actually realized that you did have to build a social network, you know, in recovery yes. and you did have to kind of redefine yourself and, you know, and seek out those areas of connection, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah, it's one thing to stop using, then it's another to actually, you know, rebuild and figure out. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And I know it is challenging for people. Like, I'm not going to say it's super easy always to make those connections in recovery because we were saying earlier, it's like you do have to put yourself outside your comfort zone.
Right.
And it is going to be scary, but like that is potentially the thing that really is going to save your life.
Right.
And like you have that choice to make, right? Like, do you want to continue living life the way you've been living it? Like, you know, it doesn't work. You wake up hating yourself, you're not happy, or do you want to take a chance
right.
on a new life and trying something new? Because I think too, it's like, it's very true for like just my life today. I have a business with a huge team and everything too. So it's funny because recovery is very similar to what I do business-wise and team building, leadership, personal development with these people. And I think we underestimate what we're capable of.
Right.
And when we think back to like when we were children, you know, like we try over and over again. Like when we learn to walk, did we stop the first time because it was hard?
Right.
No, we tried again and again and again. Same with talking.
The resiliency just, yeah. right.
Yeah. We made mistakes. Yeah. We tried again, right? Like we got told no how many times? We kept going.
Mm-hmm.
So like dig deep into that. Like we are capable of doing that. Every single human being is capable of doing hard things.
Right.
It's just making that choice and that decision.
You're going to stick with
it. To doing it.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So just to kind of finish off your story here, where you had a social work degree and you didn't become a social worker.
No, I didn't.
Okay. That's
no, no.
I think that's great, I actually. Didn't.
Yeah, it's so funny.
Yeah. So what, you know, obviously you probably had some conviction getting into the field and like that's a hard degree to get.
Yes. And I loved it. Like I learned lots, which was great. And yeah. I mean, I always worked like with people in recovery, right? And like I sponsored lots of women. I did, you know, speaking things, all that, right? I always did stuff. But when I graduated, I started to look at jobs available. And at the time, they're like $15 an hour. And I'm like, I did not just put myself in $40,000 worth of student loan debt.
Right.
To get paid $15 an hour. Like I just didn't. I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
And my girlfriend was working in government at the legislature at the time. And I was like, oh, government job. My parents have always told me to get a government job because benefits, pension, all that kind of stuff. And I ended up getting a job in politics.
Really?
It's so random. I knew nothing about politics. Before my interview, I had to Google who's the premier. What? Like so what party is in power?
How'd you pull that off?
Well, I memorized it.
Okay. you're faking it till you make it. Yeah.
And it was so funny because I didn't know anything I was doing. And it was right before an election where they thought the party that I was working for wasn't going to get reelected. And so I wasn't guaranteed a job past a few months in. Yeah. But that party did get reelected and they actually wanted me back because I did such a good job.
No way.
Yeah, which was cool. And I'm really grateful for that experience. I ended up working there for about 2 years and I learned a lot about politics. And I think the biggest takeaway for me in that was that like what we see in the media is so not true of what's actually going
on. What's going on, of course.
At all.
Right.
At all. And I'm like, wow, they twist everything.
Right.
And just how like even political parties against each other, like it's wild. They act like high school teenagers, like the insults at each other. I'm like, really? Like, how is this a thing?
Our
government.
How are we like, accepting this? I've always wondered that.
It's so ridiculous, and at the same time, it's very entertaining.
Right? Yeah, but, yeah. So you had front row.
I did
front row seats for 2 years. Amazing.
And I learned a lot, which I'm really grateful for. And working in the legislature, which is like a staple of Victoria, it's this iconic thing. Yeah. Like that was really cool, and I'm grateful for that. And then after that, I actually ended up working at Cedars. After that,
you did.
I did, just not in a counseling position.
Okay.
I worked with the clinical team for a little bit and like as an assistant. And I liked being in that environment. Like it felt very comfortable and at home for me. But then I decided to take a break and try my hand at mortgages for a year and that failed miserably.
Good for you for trying all this though.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm all for that too, you know? Try new things.
Then that's the thing I can say confidently in my life that I've done is try new things and many of them have failed, but I just keep going.
Right.
So I'm like, what else am I going to do? Right. Like sit around and sulk and not try again? Like, no, I'm not going to do that. Like, like if I want my life to change, it's up to me.
Right.
The reason why that job failed, I would say though, was because I was in a really abusive relationship. And that's something about my recovery. It's that, I stayed sober from alcohol and drugs, but I was in a lot of toxic relationships. Mm-hmm. Like that was my lesson.
That was, right.
I had not learned to fully love myself and value myself and find self-worth. It took years for me to get there. So I ended up in like some really awful situations. And so when I was doing mortgages, I was also in this very abusive relationship, like physically, mentally, emotionally. And so I was so depressed and I became a shell of who I was. And I felt almost, if not worse than how I felt before I went to rehab, which was terrifying for me too.
Yeah.
And thankfully I got out of that relationship. Like it took a lot, like me talking to my sponsor, all my friends in recovery, having counseling, my parents, I phoned the police. I ended up doing victim services, like, because I just kept going back and I never understood abusive relationships before. Like I'd be like, why do those women always go back? Well, it's an addiction cycle.
Right.
There is like brain chemicals where it's like you get addicted to that high and low.
Right.
And it's still hard for me to describe it because I did view myself as like this strong woman who had a lot going for me. And that's how people saw me too. And then all of a sudden just became the shell of myself. Okay. And so that was hard. And I remember my friend once being like, Steph, you used to walk into a room and like you would light up the room and, you know, heads would turn. And yeah. Now you walk into the room and you look at the ground.
Right.
Like, and your light's dim. And I hated hearing that.
How hard was it for you to maintain your recovery during that time? Like, was it compartmentalized? Was that two different aspects or?
Yeah. Like I still went to meetings. I felt really depressed. I didn't have a sponsor at the time. And I walked into an old home group of mine where I knew my sponsor, what my old sponsor was. And her and I did not leave on good terms. And that was like years prior. And I was sitting there and I guess she saw the look on my face. I went to the bathroom and she followed me in and was like, are you okay? Yeah. And I just started bawling and I was like, no. Wow. And then she gave me a hug and she's like, let's go for coffee. And like our relationship has been so good since.
Okay.
And we rekindled that and she helped me a lot through that. So again, like this is where recovery came in clutch and the people right. of recovery like had my back again.
And they know you enough to and care about you enough to actually intervene and say
to
something.
Follow me to right. the bathroom and ask. Yeah. Right. And that's what I love about recovery so much is that like it doesn't matter where you are in the world. Mm-hmm. Like there's recovery.
Mm-hmm.
Anywhere you go, like I've been traveling to Vietnam, Thailand, Mexico, Barcelona, Australia. I've been to AA meetings, all those places.
Okay.
And it's cool because like it's your family, but they're strangers.
Right.
So I like that. And so, yeah, recovery had my back again in that situation with the abusive relationship. And it did help me, but I had to find my own way out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And what ended up happening is I had to phone the cops again. And they had to come check my welfare and in walks my future ex-husband checking my welfare. So now we're like, okay, that's kind of a messed up situation, right?
Okay.
Because like that, like he was checking my welfare. I'm like, oh my God, you're my knight in shining armor. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And we end up getting together like a month later. So I now look at that I'm like, oh my God, that's so toxic. I can look back on that. But at the time, I really think he served a purpose because it got me away from my really abusive ex. It got me away from the toxic people that I allowed into my life at that time.
Yeah.
And he had two kids. So I instantly became a stepmom. I loved them. Like I still love them. I'm actually taking my stepdaughter to Morgan Wallen tonight.
Okay.
Yeah. And cool. She's 17, first year of UVic now. Okay. And I love that. And then we ended up getting pregnant 6 months into our relationship. So with my son, Hunter, who's 6 years old. And it's just so interesting because I truly believe that like God puts people into our life for a reason. And I know that my ex was put into my life for that reason. Like it allowed me, even though like he wasn't great, we have a good relationship now, co-parenting, but like, I'm not going to slander him on here, but he wasn't great.
Yeah.
He did allow me to heal a lot from that other relationship.
Sure. Right.
And then also give me this most beautiful boy.
Right.
Ever.
Okay.
And so I was very, very active in recovery, lots of meetings, doing all that. And, you know, I just realized becoming a mother, it gave me a whole other purpose to life.
Right.
And it just made me very grateful because I was like, Hunter's never going to have to see me drink or use drugs.
Right.
Ever.
It's pretty amazing that, right. You've been so solid in your recovery by the time
he gets this version of me.
Right.
Not the lost, empty soul that I was when I was in addiction and all the things that go along with it too, right? Because when I was holding him as a newborn, I just realized like how innocent all these newborns that are being born. Right. They're being built, I guess.
In a way, yeah.
they're so innocent and not everyone has like, you know, parents that are capable of showing them love because they're in their own addiction or mental health,
right?
And
they don't have the capacity.
They don't have the capacity. And so it just gave me a lot of compassion for kids and for adults, because a lot of us adults who struggle with mental health and addiction
started back
before, right? But it definitely gave me a new purpose to life to be like, I really, truly, truly want to become the best version of myself.
Right.
Because if I want him to be the best version of himself and I want him to go after his dreams and think anything's possible, I need to show him.
You got
to
do it.
I got to show him. Right. And I also want him to grow up learning about recovery.
Right.
Because like it can be generational, right? Like it can be genetic. Absolutely. Both my grandpas were alcoholic. My parents weren't. So it can be. And I want him to know that there's a safe place to go. And I want it to be an open topic of discussion.
Right. Yeah. Same thing. Yeah. No stigma, no shame, no guilt. No. We'll just talk about it.
No.
Yeah.
No. Cool. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty amazing. And so 6 years old now, it's...
He's six. Yeah, it goes by so fast. It's so crazy. It sure does.
Yeah. I always say it's the best and the hardest thing that I've ever done.
It challenges you in so many ways.
Absolutely.
Like, it's so hard in so many ways, but also the best thing ever.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Ever.
Like I said, the hardest and the best thing I've ever done, right?
Yeah. Like I would never choose not to be a parent now that I am.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I can't even imagine it, right?
No.
Yeah, at that point. Yeah, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always say too, it kind of, it forces you to really look at your values, like you say, and who you are and, and you want to put your best foot forward to show and set that path so that your kids can, right?
Well, and it makes me stay on top of my recovery and my own well-being, my own health and all those aspects, because even if I'm not slipping back into addiction, into actually using substances, we can sometimes slip back into old behaviors.
Absolutely.
That are unhealthy and not helpful. And so having him is just like that extra reminder of like, no, like he deserves the best version of me.
Yeah.
And the best version of me is in recovery. It's also taking care of my health, exercising, eating healthy food, taking care of my mental health, like learning and growing. There's a lot to it.
Totally.
Right. And that's something I know I've talked about 12 step. Right. And like, I don't go as much anymore, like maybe like once a year over the last couple of years, to be truthful. Yeah. But that the 12 steps really gave me the foundation of life, of like how to live life as a human being. Right. It gives you like those values and like steps on what to do, right? Like it's to turn your life and will over to your higher power, right? Like to not always just think I'm in charge and I can do anything and everything, like but also like how to say sorry, how to look at our defects, like the things that are holding us back, and actually being honest about it, because it's baffling to me that so many people walk around and don't do that don't look at themselves in the mirror being well, this is on me.
and having those points of inventory of actually being like, am I selling myself a line? Like, am I actually doing what I think I'm doing right now? And actually being conscious and aware of who we are and the impact we're making. Right?
Yes, that's it. It's like being aware of your own behaviors. Because to me, nothing's worse than being stagnant. Like today, nothing is worse to me than not growing. Right. Like I don't ever want to stop growing. Like I love it.
We're not here for too long. We've got to keep on growing.
No, and I want to see what I'm capable of. Yeah. Right?
I love
to see it. And also the other thing about the steps was that nightly inventory.
Mm-hmm.
What can I do better? Right. Who do I owe amends to?
Okay.
How would I handle that situation different?
Yeah.
That's something I just like now it's so ingrained in my head that I actually walk around thinking that, like, if I leave a situation and it doesn't feel right to me in my gut, I'm like, okay, what do I need to check out here?
Right.
What is it? And I like that I can ask myself that, right? Yeah. Because then it gives me the opportunity to change things going forward.
So you've made that kind of daily practice. Hey?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I'm such a preacher of of the inventory. Yeah.
It's huge.
And actually making practice of it, because if not, all of a sudden we can get back into our kind of subconscious ways and not being aware, right?
That's
so
exactly
it's that routine of actually looking back. However that looks like to you, but
And like for me too, right? Because I said, like I don't go to as many meetings now, but I talk to people in recovery almost daily. Like my best friends are in recovery. We talk all the time. Yeah. I'm reading personal development books daily. I'm listening to personal development podcast daily.
Right.
Like I'm doing. You're
still working your recovery.
Yeah.
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 It just looks different for you
at this stage of the game.
Yeah.
At this stage. Would I recommend that for someone in early recovery?
Right.
Absolutely not.
Right.
Like I think, and I say this actually to a lot of people, is like, I think people who are in early recovery, like go to meetings, like go, and obviously find a pathway that works for you. Like I'm, recovery isn't linear and the same for everyone. I know that. We know that. But like for me, I wouldn't be where I am today without going to those meetings.
Find a way to connect, get out of your head,
yes.
talk about your struggles,
yes.
hear other people's struggles and relate to that and get empowered through that. Yeah.
And, totally. And like, take what you like and leave the rest. Yeah, I didn't like everything I heard at meetings.
Yeah.
It didn't resonate all with me, but I held on to the things that I did connect with.
Right.
That's what I held on to. Yeah. And then I also realized that everyone who's sharing in the meetings too, like they're just human. Mm-hmm. Like they're also, sick in
their
own ways.
Like,
it doesn't mean just because they have more time than me that what they said is right. Like if it doesn't feel right to me, that's okay.
Yeah.
Take what you like, leave the rest. Like if you don't like some of the words in the literature, change them out in your head.
Right.
Like if you don't like the word God, change it out every time it's said to higher power, universe, the sun, whatever you want it to be.
Right.
It doesn't have to be black and white.
However you want to interpret it.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think sometimes people get too caught up in that, or like going to a specific meeting that they don't like, or there's someone there that they don't like, that like, we just got to give it a chance. So I'd say anyone in early recovery, like I highly recommend putting yourself in the middle of recovery, like going to meetings, making those connections, following the suggestions. They're there for a reason. I didn't listen to all of them, but like, I do understand why they're there. I wish I would have, but totally. I had to take my will back and do it myself on some of those things. But yeah, it looks a little bit different for me today. And I like, I love my life today. I'm really grateful for it.
So, and what are you doing? You're jet setting all over the world. Yeah. You've got your own company. What does it look like now? Now you're a mother of a 6-year-old.
Oh my gosh.
It's a busy life.
My life has been insane. Like, I need to write a book one day because like, there's so much more to it than this. But so I actually ended up working at Ravensview, the mental health and addiction treatment center. Yeah. I was part of the startup team there and I loved it. Like,
it's a really, really special program.
It was really great. Yeah. Like, I got to be the first face that people saw. Like, I was the one to connect with them, to get them into treatment. And it's something I just genuinely love doing because I love connecting with people. And because I've been in their shoes,
you're the perfect person to write.
Yeah, I'm like, I know it's scary. I've been there and like, I will be here with you to walk you through. Like, I'll hold your hand. You can do this.
Right.
And I loved that. But while I was working there, that's when my marriage fell apart and Hunter was 2. Mm. And like, my whole life came crumbling. Like, there was all these lies I found out about. It was just a dark time. Right. But I'd been watching my girlfriend do a network marketing business, Arbon, and I watched her life change significantly. So I had reached out to her asking her about it. And when my husband had asked me for a divorce, she asked me, like, what do you want your life to look like in 5 years? And I was like, well, I want to buy a house. Like, I want to go traveling. Like, I want to take Hunter to Disneyland. I don't want to be in debt. I don't want to be stressed out about money. And she's like, okay, are you gonna get there if you keep doing what you're doing right now? And I was like, no, like, unless I win the lottery, no, it's not like I was making bad money, but it wasn't, as a single mom too, like it wasn't going to be the income that would be able to do those things.
It's going to get you by. Yeah.
And so I decided to start my network marketing business while working full time, while going through a divorce, while having a 2-year-old. So my life was insane.
Holy.
And I just ran with it because as soon as 2, she also asked me this other question, which was like, what do you want your life to look like if you're earning X amount of dollars per month? And it was like well over a 5-figure, just as a hypothetical. What would you want your life to look like if you're making this amount of money a month? What would it look like? And I'm like, I don't know. She's like, I want you to think about it. I was like, okay, I'll think about it. She's like, no, right now, like on the phone, I want you to think about it and then tell me. And that's when I started to dream big. And I was like, oh my God, why have I never dreamt big before? Why have I not actually been like, you are capable of doing more? And like, why? And that's when I just caught the vision and I ran for it. So I ended up promoting to the top of the company about not even a year and a half after I started my business. And I quit Ravensview. So I quit my full-time job. So now I work for myself. I do mostly all online. And it's the best thing. It's a health and wellness company. So it aligns fully with my values.
Totally. Okay.
And like being healthy, being our best self. And like I said earlier, it reminds me a lot of recovery too, in terms of the personal development, the community, the team calls are like meetings, having a sponsor is like your upline and someone to mentor you. Like, it's so cool. So amazing. I love it because I also get to help a lot of, it's mainly women, some men, change their lives and become the best versions of them.
So you see other people just getting empowered through. Yeah.
And a lot of these people are in recovery too, which is really cool to see a lot of these people in recovery. But so life's really good. And I'm really grateful for it because this allows me the flexibility, one, to like be here with you today. Like, I don't have to go to a job today. Right. Like, I was at the coffee shop working on my laptop before, but I get to choose my hours. I get to drop Hunter off at school like I did this morning.
Right.
I get to pick him up.
What a difference that makes.
Absolutely. I bought a house for us.
You're part of the school community.
Did.
Wow.
Yes.
Good for you.
And one of my goals too is to take him to Disneyland. And I knew when I became a single mom that it was going to take me 10 years. Like, I was like, it's going to take me like 10 years to save up for this kind of trip.
Right.
Well, I got to take him a couple years ago. And
that's
then
so cool.
I've taken him every year since now.
Really?
Like, it's just, wild. And it always comes back to recovery for me. I'm not going to lie. Like, because I wouldn't be where I am today without recovery.
Right.
Straight up.
Right.
I wouldn't.
Yeah.
It made me who I am today. It gave me these tools, the foundation, the personal development tools. Like, it really gave me that grit and to show me that I can stick with something and that it is possible to change my life.
Right.
And I know that because I've seen so many other people's lives change too.
Absolutely.
And
well, we always see that, like, the gift of recovery. I always say that, you know, the fact that you had to, just based on circumstances and getting to where you are, it forced you to actually figure out who you are and what you're doing, you know, and how, and self-practice and discipline and all that stuff. It kind of forced your hand, but a lot of people, they don't go there, you know, because they haven't been challenged like that. Right. So
it's scary.
I look at it as, So I look at it as, you know, those gifts of recovery. It's it's such a positive, right? So
it really is. Cause I think a lot of us, and this is true in recovery too. It's like, it's obviously it's way more comfortable to sit inside our comfort zone. It really is, but that's not where we're going to find growth.
Right.
That's not where we're going to become our best selves and actually be happy is in our comfort zone. You'll have a certain level of happy. Sure. But you're not going to be the happiest version and actually like beam with like your passions and life. Right. Like, we got to challenge ourselves and like how we build confidence is by challenging ourselves.
Right.
Right.
And then beating those goals. And
exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So no, life's really good today and I'm grateful. Like, I really am.
That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you know, for me, I just see how much you put into practice that is, you know, what we are always talking about, you know, like getting connected, you know, talking about your recovery, having that inventory and practice. So it seems like you really took it at such a young age too. I think that's incredibly admirable that you took that and obviously took advice of people around you and, you know,
And that's the thing too. Like, I was really young, but it's never too late to get into recovery.
Absolutely.
Or too early to get into recovery.
Right.
Like, and if you're young and listening to this, like, you're not going to miss out on anything by getting in recovery. I promise you.
Yeah, the opposite.
It's the opposite. You'll miss out on things if you stay in your addiction.
Right.
Like, you will. And I've seen it time and time again. And I am just so grateful that I got sober at a young age, that like I didn't have to try doing it now with Hunter, because I know that that would add a whole level of complication and guilt and shame
and impact his life in such a way too.
Yeah but I've worked with the most incredible people, like in recovery and at those jobs and even in my current position too, where like that's one of my favorite things about recovery is seeing the change in people. Like seeing how they come in and they're like down and out,
right?
And then seeing them flourish in life,
that light come back.
And it's not always linear, like I said, like, you know, like relapse can be part of people's story, and I think that we need to remove that shame.
Absolutely.
About it, especially because in the program we count time. And like, sure, it's great, I have 16 years,
right,
but like, let's say if I were to relapse, it doesn't mean that 16 years went to waste.
That's right.
Like,
absolutely.
It doesn't.
We're not starting from scratch.
No.
Yeah.
No. And so I think sometimes like counting the time can add that shame element.
I have mixed feelings about it too.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's great because I love celebrating.
Same.
And I love celebrating accomplishments. But as soon as pride becomes too attached to recovery, I get worried, right? You know, because I don't think that's what it's about, right? You know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's showing people it's possible.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's great, but you know, and it's, you're totally right. You're never starting from scratch. If something happens and you have that setback. And I always think that shame and guilt is like fuel to the fire. It's like, that's what our addiction eats up.
Exactly.
Right? It just eats that shit up.
Exactly.
And that's what it wants.
Yes.
That's its food. So, you know,
as
soon as we start buying into that, then it's just, you know,
exactly.
Addiction is taken over again.
Exactly.
Right?
So. And it's just like, also maybe you didn't relapse, but like you did something that doesn't align with who you are. And it's like being a bit gentle with yourself, realizing you're a human being.
Right.
You're not going to be perfect. We make mistakes all the time. It's what we do with it.
Right.
So like, get back on the horse, like whether it's get back to meetings or like read a book or like make amends or whatever it is. Right.
Yeah.
It's just like, get back up.
Right.
And also the thing about relapse too, is it happens often a long time before people actually do.
Right.
With the behaviors. So it's starting to like, it's figuring out where did you start going down the wrong path? What was it?
Yeah.
Because that self-awareness is so key.
Right.
To like actually living a good life. It's like
Absolutely.
Being self-aware of what's going on. Cause like, I know, like if I start isolating and I'm thinking in my head and I'm thinking in circles, I'm like, this is not doing me any good.
Right.
Like I need to get to a meeting. I need to talk to somebody. I need to change the way my thoughts are thinking right now. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's hard to do, but we can learn how to do that too.
Right.
But meetings are a good place for that. So anyways, I did just want to say that too, that like, I know it's not always linear, and whatever,
absolutely,
whatever way your way to recovery is, it's like, we just encourage you to keep going and to get there. And I know there's many different pathways, and you know, not, it's not one size fits all for everybody, but I'm just like a huge, I think, fan of people living their best lives,
right,
whatever that looks like. And if you're truly happy, then I'm happy for you.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have those slips, just keep on getting up and keep on trying again.
We're here for you.
That's right.
We're here for you.
You got the support here.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Man, I'm so glad you came on today. This has been a really good chat. And I'm just really, really happy that you can come on and just be such a strong spokesperson, especially for women, in this community. And like you said, I wish more people could speak so openly about recovery, mm-hmm, as you, because I think it's so empowering and people need to hear it. So, hopefully everybody listening today, really has a lot of takeaways. I know they will. So
awesome. Thanks so much for having me on.
Awesome.
And
thank
I hope you guys enjoyed
amazing
it.
Okay. Absolutely. Totally. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Okay. What did I say? Don't you think she's charismatic? I think she's charismatic. Thank you once again to Stephanie for coming onto this program and sharing your story. I really feel like Stephanie is such a strong voice for women in recovery, not only in our community, but in the greater recovery community. So thank you so much for taking the time. It really means a lot. And once again, Stephanie was one of the members of our cohort of this year's recovery campaign, and I will be having on more members of the cohort in the months to come. Our next podcast will be in 2 weeks' time. I'm going to be taking a little bit of a departure from our typical model and bringing on a really special guest. So excited for that. Please stay tuned. In the meantime, please keep spreading the word, not just about this podcast, but about Umbrella Society and the work we do to help support individuals, but also just about recovery in general. Let's start having these hard conversations. I think that addiction is a topic that has become quite political and quite divisive, and I really think we need to break down those barriers and just have that conversation about how we can best help and serve those that are struggling with substance use and addiction challenges in their life. I'm really a firm believer that we need to drop stigma and drop maybe preconceived ideas and really just try to work together to find a solution. So, once again, let's keep this conversation going. In the meantime, you will not hear from us for a couple of weeks, but then we will be back, and this is going to continue right through probably until the spring. So please keep listening. We have some great podcasts coming up in the near future. Until then, from Victoria, BC, my name is Blake Anderson.